Hello, this is John Cleese, and you're listening to the Podcast Network.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. And now, here's Rod Adams and the Atomic Show. It's atomic. Yeah. It's atomic.
Hello, this is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 106. And tonight I have a special guest. He is N. Nadir, who blogs at Daily Cause. He is, like me, a person who believes strongly that it is illogical to consider the byproducts of nuclear fission to be waste when they, one, can still contain 95% of the potential energy, and two, contain some very interesting and potentially useful additional products. This show is being recorded on the 17th of September 2008, just a few days after Hurricane Ike hit the Gulf Coast of the United States. One of the show's sponsors, Entergy Corporation, had more than 700,000 customers in Texas, Louisiana, and Arkansas lose power. While I'm talking to you now, about 14,000 Entergy employees are out restoring power to as many of the customers as quickly as possible. Those workers bring a lifeline back to people in devastated areas, providing power to run hospitals, turn on the lights at night, restore air conditioning in humid, uncomfortable areas, put refrigerators back on. Those kind of things are very, very important after a storm of the magnitude of Ike. So when you're thinking about what kind of work you can do that can provide service to people, there are a few places in the economy where you can do that better than in the electric power industry. And if you're interested in learning about how you can become a line worker or engineer or a system restorer, grid operator at a place like Entergy Corporation, or where you want to learn more about operating nuclear power plants that actually provide the power that the transmission lines bring, you can find out more by visiting nuclearenergycareers.com. That's nuclearenergycareers, all one word, .com. Now back to my talk with N. Nadir on the subject of recycling used nuclear fuel. How are you tonight?
I'm very good, Rod. It's a pleasure to talk to you as always. And I can't wait to talk a little bit more about my favorite subject, the chemistry of nuclear fuels.
Well, good. You've been kind of quiet on Daily Cause recently. What's going on in your life that's causing you to?
I've been. There's a couple issues going on. One is I make no secret of the fact that I am a Democrat and a liberal, and I'm very happy that our candidate, Mr. Obama, mentioned nuclear clearly in his acceptance speech, and you know, part of the effort that I've made at Daily Cost has been to try to make it clear to Democrats. We've been a little weak, even though Glenn Seaborg was one of the most famous Democrats ever, as you and I talked about in the past. My party has not been 100% perfect on nuclear issues, on nuclear energy issues. And I'm very satisfied now that that period is coming to an end. I don't think we're going to have too many more Michael Dukakis types as our nominee. So, you know, the question of, I've personally experienced a lot of a lot of the Democrats have come to me and said, you know, you've really changed my thinking about nuclear energy. Very clearly, the external costs of nuclear energy are much lower than really any of the alternatives. You know, last time you and I talked, we talked a little bit about solar, and I looked into the matter a little bit further, and I'm now convinced totally that nuclear is a lower external cost and a better environmental profile than solar energy. And so, you know, that's one issue. The other is that I've been working very, very hard at my various projects. And I've been spending a lot of time. Sometimes I need to go back and kind of raise the level a little bit. And I've been doing a lot of research in the literature and in connection with nuclear chemistry. So, you know, all these things have kind of impacted the feeling that I need to write, and also kind of want to raise the level a little bit, maybe.
Well, that's good. I hope that your pleasure or satisfaction in helping to change the conversation on the political level doesn't result in any complacency. There's still an awful lot of naysayers out there and people who don't understand what it is they're really fighting for when they fight against nuclear power.
I hear you on that. I hear you on that. And I wouldn't say it's complacency. I do have some personal stuff going on, you know. And like I said, I'm working very hard.
What do you mean? You have a life outside of the blog?
Yeah, I have a life outside of writing on costs. And the other thing is that, you know, the structure of costs is such that, you know, my work there remains available. Very easy. It's very easy now to just. When a question comes up, I often, even on other websites that I throw some things out on, I just link what I've written in the past. You know, a lot of those diaries, I don't want to be egotistical, but they're pretty well crafted in many cases, and they address, you know, there's no sense repeating it. Cost is there forever, so if you want to read about my thoughts on technetium, they're still there.
You know, I understand that, and I feel the same way many times, since I've got articles on Atomic Insights dating back to 1995. One of the neat things about the web is it turns news into permanent records, permanent archives. But the challenge that I've seen is that the opposition to nuclear energy learned the lessons of sales and marketing very well, and one of the most effective techniques, as frustrating as it is that repetition counts. And so I find myself saying the same thing many times in different ways, just so that people keep hearing it. But,
I hear you. I hear you. But you know, I'm like I say, it's not all necessarily stepping away from the debate. I mean, I think I've talked to you in the past. I mean, I think one of the most important things, as everybody knows, I live in New Jersey, and I'm very, very concerned about the status of the Oyster Creek relicensing, because this is a very important issue that impacts the health of my family directly. And we need to keep that reactor, and we need to keep this for a long time.
Yes.
And, you know, the Indian Point stuff I don't want to talk about.
Yeah. That Indian Point thing, we'll save that for the topic of another day. It's just absolutely incredible to me that an area that has as little excess capacity as New York City does, it has so many people still trying to shut down one of the most reliable power suppliers they have. And they simply don't understand the cost of the replacement fuel in a tighter market. Well, it's not even predictable. It's pretty incredible. But let's go on to this nuclear fuel chemistry.
Sure.
What are some of the really interesting and intriguing isotopes that remain in used nuclear fuel once it's removed from the reactor?
As I've said to you before, I really can't think of any isotope that's in spent fuel that doesn't have a, let's use your better word, used nuclear fuel, that doesn't have a real value. Some things are more valuable than others. Very clearly, I think everybody knows, and the Japanese with their recent reprocessing plants that they've built have begun to industrially do this, are the noble metals, specifically ruthenium, rhodium, and palladium. The world supply of rhodium from mines is about 3 tons a year is mined, which, a ton seems like a big amount, but it's actually very tiny. The supply of rhodium in used nuclear fuel is easily outstrips the supply that's available from mines. Rhodium is an element that is basically an impurity in palladium mines and nickel mines. Most of our rhodium comes from Canada. It's an extremely important catalyst. It's used in asymmetric chemistry, which is the chemistry of the three-dimensional chemistry, which is very, very important in the pharmaceutical industry. It's a very important element in catalytic converters. It has remarkable properties in terms of heat flows and a number of it's just an outstanding element, and it makes very hard alloys, for instance. So, I mean, the world can never have enough rhodium.
What, with a supply of 3 tons a year, what is the price of a pound of rhodium on the world market?
I haven't looked recently, but it's on the order of many hundreds of dollars per troy ounce. So it's more expensive. Generally higher priced than gold. It's higher priced than platinum. It's a very, 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 very valuable material. And it's not a material whose use is going to go away. The problem with rhodium is that there just will never be enough of it. And when people do chemical processing involving rhodium, in fact, I just saw there's an interesting technique used in medicinal chemical research where people use rhodium complexes of bipyridine to light up proteins at certain points. I think rhodium is one of the obvious elements that we would like to recover. The element that really concerns me the most, I think, is the one that it's not available anywhere on Earth, is technetium. I mean, I really think this metal is a very, very remarkable material. I'm happy to say very often at the Le Hague processing plant in France and at the Sellafield facilities, believe it or not, technetium was discarded and it actually ended up in the North Sea. You hear a lot of scare stories about how terrible this is, and I don't really think it represents a real health risk. In fact, if people go for imaging when they get the related isotope technetium-99m, they in fact urinate technetium-99, the decay product. So probably some people's toilet bowls end up being more radioactive than the North Sea, and nobody complains about that. But even so, the metal is extremely extremely interesting. It's a refractory metal, which means that it melts at very high temperatures. It has very interesting catalytic properties. It easily exceeds the world supply of its sister element in the periodic table, rhenium, which is a very important catalyst. And in fact, for certain types of oxidations, technetium has been explored for types of reactions that make acetone, for instance, out of isopropyl alcohol and do some very sensitive reductions. It's a really remarkable element. It's about 80 tons of it on the planet right now, all of it in used nuclear fuel. And it's just been a disgrace that for so many years this element has been dumped. I have a 1960 monograph on technetium that was actually written by the Russians and translated into English by the Israelis. There's a series called The Analytical Chemistry. And back in 1960, the Russian chemist who wrote on technetium was saying that in Russia it was a disgrace that this valuable element was being discarded. So the French have actually begun to collect their technetium, which is a very happy thing. They're accumulating 2 or 3 metric tons a year. And that material is, I have a lot of... a lot of ideas about what to do with that metal. And I'm not in favor of transmuting it. You hear a lot of talk about transmuting it. I don't think that's a particularly good idea. But some of the applications that I've been working on and thinking about are, in fact, nuclear applications. It's just a fabulous material. That's all I can say about it.
Okay, now, let me, for those people who didn't listen to our first talk, you work professionally in the chemistry field, right?
That's right.
Okay.
But I'm not as a nuclear chemist, believe
right.
it or not.
I mean, I know that nuclear chemistry is more of a hobby for you, but, I mean, when it comes right down to it, many of the people that did all of the discovery for nuclear materials were trained as classical chemists chemical engineers before they got interested in nuclear technologies during
right.
the 1950s and 60s.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah, it's nuclear chemistry is a very narrow field, and perhaps not very many people have been even trained in that field in the U.S. in the last 25 or 30 years.
Yeah, there's a tremendous shortage, in my view, of nuclear chemists. In fact, I was at the recent American Chemical Society meetings, which were here in Philadelphia, and I went to a couple of talks on the need for nuclear scientists, and the numbers are kind of scary to me. I mean, less than 50% of people entering graduate programs in nuclear chemistry today are native-born American citizens. Most of them come from China. There's a fair representation of, Europeans. But I think we're graduating, well less than 100 PhDs every year in nuclear chemistry, and that's got to change. That has really got to change. And the impetus for doing that is, of course, funding. You know, we need to really transition into the future. We need more nuclear chemists.
Yeah, one of the things that gets thrown around a lot in the anti-nuclear literature is the idea that nuclear fission is somehow oversupplied with government subsidies, but when it comes to looking at the research grants available, nuclear has had a tremendous shortfall in even having anything for a professor or a researcher to apply for.
Well, I have a diary for Daily Kos, more or less written on the topic of subsidies. It was inspired by another writer on another website, Democratic Underground. And it has all of my usual sarcasm.
I'd say it isn't so.
And I haven't published it yet, and I probably will publish it in the future. The question of subsidies, for me, the nuclear subsidy can never be high enough. I think you have to look at the value of subsidies. You have to look in return on investment terms. And if the nuclear subsidy were $100 billion, which is a number that I certainly could live with, that would be fine with me, because I think we have a responsibility to the future. None of us are going to live all that much longer, but we have a responsibility to the future to really turn over secure energy system. And nuclear gives however many dollars you sink into it. The return in terms of exajoules per $1 billion is just enormous compared to the more politically popular things like solar and wind
and fusion.
Fusion. That's pretty funny you mentioned, because I was overusing the PPL library over here at Princeton recently.
when it comes to a return on investment in terms of energy output, fusion has got to be one of the lowest ever, with multiple billions of dollars invested and not a kilowatt hour out, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that. And I've actually talked to some. I live in the Princeton area in New Jersey, and I've been to PPL on some of the tours that they've had, and I've had conversations there with PPL scientists, and they really do some wonderful wonderful science education programs here. I don't want to see these guys defunded necessarily. I've toured the tokamak that they have over there. It's very, very nice. It's got all these little radioactive symbols on it,
But it's not an energy program.
No, it really isn't. I don't see when you hear people sort of do this rote thing saying, oh, fusion is the answer and blah, 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 blah. And almost zero of those people understand that any fusion technology that works will depend on fission infrastructure. You cannot, when they talk about breeding tritium, even if they could do it, which I'm not sure that they can, when they talk about breeding tritium, they're talking about doing this by bombarding thorium or bombarding curium or bombarding, some actinide. And really, the world supply of tritium right now is available from CANDU fission reactors. Canadians hold most of the world's tritium. It's about 18 kilos, enough to run a fusion reactor if it worked for about 6 months. So I don't think that's kind of a, as an energy program, it's not really, as a science program, I have nothing against it. But I would really like to see an enormous investment worldwide, not just here in the United States, in fission research, because it's really possible to do some very great things now.
What do you say to people who say things like, "Well, we have to solve the waste issue now. We can't leave it for future generations. We can't leave our mess behind."
Well, this is a really, in my writings, if you read them, I always call that concern arbitrary. Okay. I agree with the sentiment that we have a responsibility to leave as little waste of any kind. But the really big problem on the planet right now is not used nuclear fuel. The big problem right now is fossil fuel waste. There is no way to deal with fossil fuel waste. There is no repository for fossil fuel waste. Climate change, which is, people say, if you believe in climate change, well, it's not a matter of belief. It's, it's pretty well understood that it's a real thing. And the climate change is, in fact, a waste problem. Okay? Right. There's no other word for it.
It's part of the deadly fossil fuel waste.
Right. And, you know, when I refer to, in my writings, when I refer to fossil fuels, I always append the word dangerous. I never say fossil fuels, I always say dangerous fossil fuels. And I refer to it as dangerous fossil fuel waste. And the literary reason for doing that is to reiterate that that in fact, in the nuclear case, these are the only kind of energy waste that we actually do know what to do with. It's not a technical problem; it's a perceptual problem. And you know, what would I do with used nuclear fuel? Yeah, there are two ways of looking at it. You can say to yourself, well, the price of uranium and thorium is low enough that we don't really need to reprocess.
But you know, the funny thing is that usually you can catch people who say something like that. In another discussion, they'll say, well, there's not enough uranium to make nuclear power last long enough to matter much, so we need to go to something else.
And that's
the inconsistency of that is so hard for me to deal with.
I
get frustrated.
It's a very incredible statement, really. It's kind of appalling on some level because, I don't know if we actually captured it. We're hoping to bring Kirk Sorensen and his colleague from Energy from Thorium online. And one of the things that I wanted to talk to them about, and hopefully we could do this in the future, was, you know, this this discussion of is thorium, thorium is they say the common statement is that there's four times more thorium than uranium. That's not really 100% true. Actually, there's about 3.5 billion tons of uranium in seawater, and it's not incredibly expensive or prohibitively expensive to recover that uranium. There's a very, very well-developed series of Japanese papers in industrial chemical engineering research that gives one approach. The French have another approach. So uranium can be thought of, in my perception, and this was an idea that was developed maybe a decade or so ago by Bernard Cohen, is that actually uranium is the true renewable fuel. All of the internal heat of the Earth derives from uranium, thorium, and a small amount of radioactive potassium. And as such, you can argue that every geothermal plant is, in fact, a nuclear plant. I just don't see that. I've done the calculation, and the material that is available and used nuclear fuel right now as uranium-238 represents enough to supply the entire planet with energy for all purposes, eliminating every other form of energy, coal, oil, solar, wind, whatever, for about 10 or 15 years. And that's enough.
That's material that's already mined, already above ground, already even isolated from other rocks and minerals and stuff. It's pretty in a reasonably pure form, right?
That's correct. That's correct.
Now, does that calculation include the enormous quantity of uranium-238 in tailings from enrichment plants?
No, it does not. The phenol, if you look at that supply, the number is quite a bit larger. I am concerned, you know, in a chemical sense with phenol. I would like to see that, you know, some of that is still available as uranium hexafluoride. I'd very much like to see that material reduced. I'm not happy about that situation over there. But no, that uranium is even more. So, you know, the issue, of course, with uranium-238 is that it's not strictly fissionable material. It needs to be converted to plutonium to recover its energy value. But I personally don't have a big problem with plutonium. I believe that plutonium will play an important role in the nuclear future. It must play an important role in the nuclear future. What we need to do with plutonium is to isotopically dilute it. And the nice thing about thorium is that it gives access to plutonium-238, which has certain heat implications.
And makes great batteries.
Right, makes great batteries. But it's also very nice because, you know, I mean, people always talk to me like about this. There's a lot of confusion, I think, in the public mind. And, you know, if I go back to writing diaries, I certainly want to rehash this issue. There's a lot of confusion in the public mind about the weapons diversion. You can actually speak to some very intelligent people who say, oh, well, you know, we can't have plutonium around. I'm a Democrat. I voted for him twice, but Jimmy Carter was wrong about the plutonium issue. What we need to do is we need to move that plutonium through reactors many times. The French have done some really, if you look in the nuclear literature, the French have done some really, really very careful thinking about their plutonium inventories, and their long-term approach to managing plutonium. And it's excellent. It's just an excellent approach. They can tell you pretty much to the kilo how much they're going to have in the year 2080. And, you know, that's a very responsible thing to do because they're thinking about what will future generations have. You know, what is our responsibility, not to ourselves, but to our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren.
You know, you bring up a really interesting point and something that I have trouble explaining to people, but one of the real benefits but also challenges with regard to nuclear fuel in general is that nothing much happens fast. You know, if you want to introduce a new fuel form in a reactor, it can take you 5 to 10 years to adequately test that new fuel form because it doesn't deplete very quickly. It takes a lot of time. And one of the challenges that the nuclear fuel recycling effort had in the very early stages was we built some recycling plants, reprocessing plants, and they didn't have enough used fuel to keep the plant running. So they operated at very low capacity factors.
Well, yeah, that's that's a very interesting point. That's a really interesting point, again, that public perception is very, very weak on. If you look in any kind of process in which you have an equilibrium, I mean, well, let's start the other way. In any kind of process in which you have something being created as at the same time it is spontaneously being destroyed, and radioactive materials, of course, are spontaneously transmuting into non-radioactive materials. Anytime you have that situation, you have an equilibrium. So, in fact, if you wanted to talk about, let's say you really, really wanted a lot of ruthenium-106 for some purpose, and there are a lot of purposes that you could have that for. There is a maximum to the amount that you could have. You will slowly, asymptotically, reach this level at which it's decaying as fast as it's being destroyed. This situation does not apply really to dangerous fossil fuel waste. It doesn't apply to the chemical toxins associated with, you know, if solar ever got to one exajoule, which is not likely. It doesn't apply to that. These things can accumulate indefinitely, or at least until you've used up all the materials to construct them with.
And that's because there is no loss term. There's no destruction term in those
productions
of waste is with nuclear waste.
So there's a series of differential equations called abatement equations, and they're coupled equations. And one of the things that's happened since the early days of the nuclear era, the first nuclear era, as Weinberg called it, is the computing power has become very, very much higher. So, you know, you can look at these relatively sophisticated codes, and you can run them pretty quickly and model, you know, the evolution of nuclear materials. But to a first approximation, you know, there's a sort of a maximum, and I have some spreadsheets. I don't know if I've ever shared any of these spreadsheets with you. I think I'm not such a one, too. That, you know, kind of give you an idea, sort of a back-of-the-envelope kind of idea about how much, suppose you wanted to accumulate cesium-137. Well, there's a maximum. You know, in the first year, you might be able to make, you know, a few tons of cesium-137, but 100 years out, you'd only be making a few grams a day or a few kilos a day, and the material would start to decay as fast as it's formed. And this puts a limit on on how much of radioactive material you can accumulate. And that kind of puts some kind of economic constraint on what you can do. For instance, there were people who talked about having you know, strontium generators in every basement in the 1950s. You know, well, you can't get enough strontium 90 to do that for, you know, say even every house in California. A snap type device, you could theoretically run, you know, a few houses on it, but eventually you would be only able to accumulate enough to do, if you could do 50 houses the first year, you might only be able to do a house every year in 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, or a century out. And these are just, you know, sort of made up numbers. So, you know, it's in a way kind of sad that you can't accumulate more of this material. My concern is that we don't have enough fission products, but we certainly have enough actinides. I mean, we have a pretty good supply of plutonium. I would love to have a really large supply of uranium-233. I think that's a critical material, but you're right. It takes a while to accumulate. It takes years and years and years of irradiation. And, you know, this peak uranium thing is nonsense.
Yeah, it is nonsense. And, you know, you mentioned a little bit about the effort against the plutonium economy that was a very steady and well-supported, well-funded political movement back in the 1970s to try to persuade the world that it was important to somehow prevent plutonium from becoming a common item in international commerce because of its implications, if it's in a certain form, for being able to be diverted to weapons. But I'm a real suspicious and skeptical kind of guy. I firmly believe that there was a strong relationship between this fear of the plutonium economy and the wealth and power of the fossil fuel industry.
Well, I mean, that could be. I mean, plutonium is is a material that has certain hazards. I don't want to say that it is hazard free, but you know, if you ask which fuel is the most common fuel diverted for weapons purposes, it's not even close. It's oil. And the cause of so much war. People don't really put this into their heads very, very readily. But in fact, the attack on Pearl Harbor, okay, was motivated by, and I know that as an Annapolis graduate, you probably were taught this, was motivated by the need to protect the flank for the drive on the oil fields in what was then Dutch East Indies and is now Indonesia. The Japanese, that was their concern in attacking the American fleet, was that the American fleet would interfere with their intent to seize these oil fields, because the United States had decided we were an oil exporter at that time, and we decided to embargo oil to Japan. Similarly, being
a submariner, I know very clearly how the Japanese attack missed the part of the American fleet that eventually curtailed their access to all that oil.
That's right.
They may have gotten it out of the ground, but they never got it back to Japan.
Yeah, that's definitely true. But the point is that it was an oil war, okay? And, you know, people love to talk endlessly about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And of course, no one is trying to minimize that World War II was a nuclear war, and it's certainly not my favorite use of plutonium and uranium. But by contrast, the most commonly diverted fuel in the Second World War was oil. Napalm was invented, the fire bombings of Tokyo, of Dresden, of Hamburg were all oil diversion efforts. The war in Iraq, nobody's attacked North Korea because of its weapons of mass destruction program. So to my mind, it's very clearly an oil war. And you can really click off a number of oil wars. And of course, every jet that flies is diverted for weapons purposes. So, I mean, to discuss the potential for nuclear diversion, especially given the fact that there has not been a nuclear war since 1945, is again arbitrary. It's establishing a criteria that one applies only to the nuclear case, and that's not wise. You know, I mean, if someone really wanted to talk about weapons diversion, the best case would be to ban oil, which personally I'm in favor of doing.
Well, the other challenge that I give to people is, not only do we fight over access to oil and control of oil, by the way, people get confused. They think that a battle for oil is a battle about cheap oil, but it's a matter of who gets the resources, not what it costs, and who has control of those resources. But the other thing to note is that, generally speaking, people who have plenty don't fight over resources. And the only way I see to have plenty is to recognize the incredible energy that's stored in all of the actinides, uranium, thorium, plutonium, and to make as much use of that energy as possible.
For
as many neat and creative new ideas as we can come up with.
I absolutely agree, and I certainly want to... Speak for the element Neptunium. I wrote a very nice diary on Neptunium and on the great scientist Lise Meitner and her role in Neptunium on Daily Kos. That's one I'm very proud of.
She's one of my heroes, by the way.
Yeah, she was just really an outstanding human being, besides being an outstanding scientist. And, you know, just to make it clear, she is the discoverer of nuclear fission, not Otto Hahn.
Right. Otto Hahn didn't know what he was doing. He had to explain it to him.
So, she made a claim in her life, didn't press it very hard, for having been the discoverer of Neptunium, and probably she's got a case. She had a case. She's passed away. But Neptunium is really a key material because it gives access to plutonium-238. We cannot uninvent nuclear weapons. That's been the case since 1945. What we can do is to minimize the probability of their construction and use. One of the nice things about the Gore administration was that they took a lot of uranium from Soviet nuclear weapons, ended up in U.S. reactors, and that was a great thing. I think we should have gone further and taken that plutonium back and run it through.
Well, we are doing a little bit of that. Unfortunately, the U.S. has taken a much longer path to converting former weapons plutonium into useful reactor fuel, but we are building a mixed oxide fuel plant at the Savannah River site that is supposed to take about 34 tons of material from weapons programs and turn it into fuel for reactors, but it won't be operating until about 2016 as currently scheduled.
That's a great thing. I mean, really, the key to minimizing the potential for nuclear weapons diversion passes directly through reactors. And again, turning back a little bit to Neptunium, Neptunium gives you access to plutonium-238. You capture one neutron, and there's decay, beta decay, to give plutonium-238. And the heat implications and the radiological implications of uranium-238 are just a tremendous tool, I think, for the future, for minimizing the risk of weapons use of plutonium.
Yeah, it's hard to build a bomb if the material keeps getting so hot that it puts itself out of the right shape.
Yeah, I mean, there's even other things. You know, for instance, the alpha radiation has impact on the reliability of the chemical explosives that are used to detonate nuclear weapons. And, you know, there are other isotopes, of course, that are available. I mean, we can kind of go through them. Plutonium-239, of course, is the working stuff. Plutonium-240, you can make a nuclear weapon in the presence of plutonium-240, but again, it's very difficult because you have a lot of neutrons coming from that isotope, and it... results in the chlorine fizzle that everybody was laughing at a few years ago was almost certainly a consequence of having too much plutonium-240 in their fuel. So again, we can't disinvent nuclear weapons, but we can make their use extremely unlikely, and that's the only thing that we will ever be able to do, is to reduce the probability. And I think that the only path to doing that, it goes through reactors. I mean, if you want to reduce the probability of nuclear war, you must have nuclear reactors. This is any scheme to bury it, hide it, put it under the rug, whatever, is more risky than running it through a reactor.
Right. And there is no other way to turn fissile material into something that cannot fission,
right?
Then running it through a reactor, and you say, if you keep actinides in reactor fuels and keep running them through, the mix of isotopes becomes so complex that it becomes almost impossible to create any kind of explosive from it.
That's absolutely the case. So, I mean, there's very, very good pacifist reasons to support nuclear energy and nuclear power. I would like to see, you know, again, you have these equilibrium-type conditions of evolving over time. I would like to see some very, very mature plutonium. And I was very happy, you know, I went through some of the CEA literature. I speak enough French that I can get by, and they also have quite a bit written in English. I'm very, very, very happy with the French approach to plutonium. It's really inspired. And we need more of that. And we, with all due respect to thorium, thorium does not really occur. The chemistry of thorium is very interesting. It doesn't occur in seawater because it's extremely insoluble. And so thorium, we're going to be stuck kind of with the land resources. So at some point in the future, if humanity is still around, long term, we're going to need to use uranium. So we might as well give as our gift to future generations an infrastructure that does that. And I think that's a very important issue because to me, I'm very concerned, you know, it's not just what's immediately, you know, best for our generation, but we really need to think what's best for the future generations. And very clearly, having that plutonium infrastructure, having access to plutonium-242 as a diluent, having access to plutonium-241 is a very good thing because it's a very it's a neutron-rich isotope that does wonderful things when it fissions. It gives up a lot of neutrons. So so I think we have a responsibility to do this. And
I also think that we have a responsibility that we need to start very soon to gift our future generations with as much of the remaining hydrocarbon resources possible. Because I know that you and I talk about the deadly waste products from fossil fuel emissions, but if we were to, in fact, slow our production of the things like carbon dioxide, which in fact does have a destruction term, there's many things in the world that absorb carbon dioxide, we could get to an equilibrium condition. And hydrocarbons are exceedingly useful materials. I'm sure you understand that as a chemist.
Well, I do.
The idea of it all turned into carbon dioxide and floating around the atmosphere rather than in a place where it can be accessed by people who want to make plastics or you know, run small engines or whatever.
Well, yeah, I of course I know this. You know, actually, I would like to see. I actually think that we're now at the point where we're going to need, in very short term, to get carbon dioxide out of the air, and we're going to need industrial energy to do that. And the only realistic source for that industrial energy is nuclear energy. And we can, in fact, reduce carbon dioxide with hydrogen to make alkanes and so forth.
Sure. If you have carbon dioxide and hydrogen, you can make hydrocarbons as long as you have a nice source of heat.
I'm a real big cheerleader for this this very simple compound, dimethyl ether, which is possibly the most remarkable fuel possible. I mean, it's just and the Asians, you know, China and Japan are well along the way to industrializing this very, very wonderful fuel, fluid chemical fuel.
What's the chemical formula for dimethyl ether?
It's CH3 bonded to oxygen bonded to another CH3. So it's kind of like two methanes with an oxygen stuck in the middle. It's just there's just a tremendous amount of literature on this compound, and I can't. If you look in my writings, I've written about DME a number of times. Two countries have active programs to make DME from nuclear power, and that's China and Korea. Both have active programs to do this, and they're really way ahead of us on that, and we really need to to look at that. It's very, very exciting technology.
That's great. One more thing, going back to the campaigns, you know, a lot of people are making a comparison between one president who somehow says he's going to build nuclear plants by himself. I don't know how that's going to work, but and another one who says he wants to find safe ways to use nuclear power. I hope that somebody is whispering in that second candidate's ear, and I'm being a little obtuse because I'm supposedly not to be involved in political action because of my professional career. But I hope somebody's whispering that he's not going to have very far to look.
Well, yeah, I made that remark actually online in a few places. Mr. Obama very clearly identified himself as the strongest pro-nuclear candidate in the Democratic primary. There's a nice video of him confronting, my hostility, but some old fool up in China who's trying to destroy the infrastructure at a Vermont Yankee. I think, you know, he has to use that rhetoric, he doesn't have to do very much. You're absolutely right. I want to take a moment to say something. You know, I have been talking in recent months, getting out a little bit more in the scientific nuclear world. And I have been talking to a number of nuclear scientists, and I want to say that a lot of people, I've spoken to a fellow over at Brookhaven, whose very important work on ionic salts was defunded. You know, they have a real palpable excitement. I think Mr. Obama is going to do the right thing with nuclear energy, and I think he knows. I don't think anybody really has to tell him that nuclear power is very clearly the safest and cleanest form of energy. It sets the world standard for safety. I mean, the solar people or the wind people or would do well to match the external cost of nuclear energy. I don't think they can, but I think they would do well to do that. And I don't think that the fossil fuel industry can ever match the low external cost of nuclear energy. It's just not possible for them to do that.
I'm going to pull a string a little bit harder. You said somebody's research has been defunded?
Yeah. Brookhaven has some world experts on a class of compounds called ionic salts. These are actually room temperature molten salts, and the molten salt concept is the chemist reactor, and as a chemist, most of the thinking that I do involves molten salt technology. Well, you know, back in the days of Weinberg, a lot less was known about molten salts. You know, the process that's used right now to recycle plutonium and recycle used nuclear fuel is the Purex process. And that process was invented in the 1950s. Okay, it's not a particularly good process, in my view. I mean, there are just a lot better approaches chemical approaches to nuclear fuel. But I can actually dig up the actual bill that, it was just one of these things that people said, well, we don't really need this. and we do. We very much do. And I'd have to tell you that the scientist, I don't know if it's whether he would want me to mention his name, but I have to tell you that, I think he's voting for Mr. Obama. Okay. So, it's not really a political issue as much as people might think.
One of the misunderstandings that people have is that the announcement of a large number of different projects or different programs over a 7 to 8 year period means that there's been a tremendous amount of new funding going on. And the reality is that I can count about 4 or 5 major new programs that have been announced regarding nuclear energy. And if you go and look at the budget, what you find is that every one of them is simply reshuffling the same money and taking it from somebody who had it and moving it to somebody who hadn't had it.
It's really
sad.
I want to reiterate, that it's very important for us to embrace our national laboratories' need to expand nuclear energy research and development. It's not really that nuclear energy is not already extremely good. Your point is well taken about Mr. Obama, making that statement. I mean, I actually think, for political reasons, he had to state it as such. But I think he knows, and I know, and that nuclear is already extremely safe. But that doesn't mean that we can't do it better.
Right.
We should always...
Just because the 8086 was a good processor doesn't mean that we stopped there.
Right. That's exactly right. We really need to... There are some open issues. One of them is if we did continuous recycling, we would begin to get a fair amount of curium and americium. And I would like to see... I don't have a problem with curium and americium. They have some nice features, actually. But it would be nice to say, okay, well, now we can easily separate these two elements and use them intelligently. It would be nice.
sometimes talking with you, I have this flashback to episodes of Sesame Street, and we could probably do a whole series of episodes. This episode brought to you by curium. This episode brought to you by americium. This episode brought to you by neptunium. Kind of like the number episodes that Sesame Street used to have. It could be a very, very educational endeavor.
I have a personal relationship with every element in nuclear fuel. I really do.
And I like to talk about the personal relationship that I had with my favorite nuclear reactors. But, hey, it's been great talking with you. I am happy that we could get together, and I know that you've got an early morning tomorrow, so I'm going to go ahead and close it up here and again say thank you very much. And
let's do it again sometime, and if you can get the Thorium fellows, I'd love to do a little roundtable with them. I want to thank Kirk and who's his colleague? Is that
Charles Barton?
Charles Barton. I want to thank them both for their excellent work in bringing those ORNL reports up onto their website. I use those quite a bit, and. So I look forward to talking in the future. Let's keep in touch, and I'll try to get a diary up so that you can be suitably amused. Take care.
Great.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Take care.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need. Something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.